Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. How much do social media companies know about you, and how easy is it to manipulate you, or me, or a whole country? Let's get to the bottom line. Unless you've been living totally off the grid, which means you'd never see this show, you know that your mobile phone is spying on you. It's telling private companies and governments where you've been, who you've met, what you've bought, and what you think. All those free apps that we use and love, ever wonder how they're free? Maybe it's because you're the one being bought and sold. We pay by giving up our personal data and our privacy, and in return, we get a service. Usually our data is used to try to sell us stuff that we may be interested in based on our personalities and our preferences. But how about when things take a darker turn and our behavior is predicted? How about tools that can manipulate our behavior or even what we believe? How about companies that work to turn up the intensity of hate in society? Should we be scared that our data is out there and in some cases being weaponized? Today we're talking with Brittany Kaiser, who worked for Cambridge Analytica in London before becoming a whistleblower and blowing the lid off that company's inner workings. Now she's a data rights activist and co-founder of Own Your Data. She wrote a book about her experiences, Targeted, My Inside Story of Cambridge Analytica and How Trump, Brexit, and Facebook Broke Democracy. And David Carroll, who teaches media design at the New School in New York and one of the best-known crusaders for data protection rights in the United States. Both Brittany and David were featured in the Netflix film The Great Hack about how the social media platforms that were supposed to connect us have actually divided and paralyzed us. Thank you both so much for joining us. David, let me just start out. You're the only one I know who set out to say, I'm going to go sue to get the rights to my data. And that is a fascinating step that you took. Why did you take it? And just to cut to the punchline, I know you didn't get your data, or at least I think you didn't as a result of the end of that film. But I just want to know, is there any chance you'll eventually win in that quest?
Sure. Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here. The initial exploration was probably purely academic, just trying to figure out how this industry works, and also working in public, posting my research to social media. And it was that way that it attracted the attention of legal minds in Europe who urged me to seek legal counsel right away. And once I started working with my solicitor, Ravi Nayak, we realized we had a very strong data protection case, and the UK Information Commissioner's Office immediately agreed that I had jurisdiction in the UK because I proved that our data was stored there. So it was the logical step to proceed, to learn more and to see if the law would allow us to exercise our rights. But we were obstructed by the company going out of business. And in the end, somebody leaked the Trump 2016 database to journalists, and it took an act of journalism to actually deliver my data from that leak in the end. So we also learned some of the limitations of being able to regulate these companies and the importance of the free press when that fails.
Well, before I bring Brittany into this, because Brittany has a foot in both sides of this story and is such an interesting life in the data world. And I want to tell our folks, one of the coolest things about Brittany is she set up Barack Obama's Facebook page ages ago in the United States Senate, which I find, you know, sort of an innocent beginning to this that took some, you know, darker turns. But I'm interested, you know, broadly in this question of what should we, David, legitimately feel and think when it comes to our own data? Because I sort of feel like we're surrounded by quick checkoff boxes, and we've largely, as a society, given up our rights and leverage in that process. Is that an incorrect assumption I'm making?
I think it's an important characteristic of the feeling that we are made to feel like we have no control. And indeed, exercising control is a lot of work. So there is an inherent asymmetry at play, and it's about power. But we are learning how to better make decisions, and we are seeing people make different decisions when they're offered a fair choice. So, for example, when Apple upgraded iOS, it asked users if they want to be tracked in their apps. Unsurprisingly, most people said no. But usually when we browse the web, we're asked to accept cookies in a manipulative way. So there's much work to be done to empower people to make informed choices, give consent, but then revoke it if they choose.
Thank you. Brittany, I mentioned the Obama story because I remember when his Facebook page went up. I think I may have written something around that time. I met President Obama, well, then Senator Obama, before he was running, and there was this new kind of, I was a blogger, and social media was important. There were sort of new waves, new infrastructure being built. And you were part of that in the early days, and then you got into this company called Cambridge Analytica. And I won't tell people all the dimensions of the show, but you became, in a way, part of the machine that took a lot of data that, you know, was out there basically overtly telling people we can change behavior and we can affect elections, and came in. And I'm just interested how that process worked, because it seems like we went from innocence to darkness rather rapidly with no speed bumps. Am I wrong in my impression?
Well, over a decade from the time that I joined Senator Obama's first presidential campaign to the time that I became a whistleblower at Cambridge Analytica, a lot developed in the data science field. When we first started building products for the Obama campaign, that was the first time that data-driven work had ever been applied to social media and politics. And we saw that all of a sudden, millions of people were registering to vote for the first time, turning out to community events, hosting watch parties for debates, and getting involved in issues that were important to their communities. So this seemed like an inherent good, but again, there were ethical and moral guidelines that were implemented on the Obama campaign where we were only doing positive messaging. Now, fast forward to Cambridge Analytica, where I was excited to join this company and learn more about how to build much more advanced tools than we had used on the first Obama campaign, of course. But there were clients that were working for the company that did not have the same sort of ethical or moral guides. Which meant that they were using negative campaigning. I think a lot of people are used to that, especially right ahead of an election this week. It's an amazing time to be talking about this, because I'm sure that you have seen and or even been bombarded with ads that are saying something negative about other candidates. Now, the amount of data that you produce and your behavioral patterns will tell companies whether you are susceptible to actually being persuaded by those negative messages or not. Some people are, others are not. And a lot of money gets plowed specifically into not just negative campaigning, but fear-based campaigning based on whether or not you could be persuaded to change your vote. And that's one of the biggest problems with data collection, is that the more data that we are producing, the easier it is to predict our behavior and therefore influence it. In the end, that's why I decided to become a whistleblower and have been working on how we actually change that, both on an educational and awareness front, on the legislative and regulatory front, as well as developing new technologies that allow you to have more control over how your data is used or not at all.
Well, Brittany, one other element here, and again, please tell me, I'm a layperson in this discussion. You both have been in it a lot more. We all focused on Cambridge Analytica. I wrote about Cambridge Analytica. We saw the story. We saw the issues regarding Facebook and governance, and we've had lots of discussions, even right now in this country, as Twitter is purchased by Elon Musk, and we see all this stuff going on. I'd love to get your views on that. But I guess really want to know, was Cambridge Analytica the tip of the iceberg? Are the behaviors, are the capacities to, in a way, repeat, perhaps less flamboyantly, what Cambridge Analytica did, still embedded in our society? Are we still seeing democracies, not only in the United States, but whether it's in Trinidad or over in France or the UK or places all around the world, are we still seeing these behaviors as part of the political ecosystem?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, many countries around the world have not yet implemented national legislation that protects individuals from their data being taken from them, bought, sold, traded, and used to target them by any organization that has the money to purchase or license that data. Even enough data is available without purchasing or licensing for you to be able to create targeted communications and campaigns for political or commercial purposes. So now, instead of one Cambridge Analytica, we have hundreds or thousands of companies that are doing something similar and are not under the guise of a certain type of regulation or legislation that would be able to protect people's rights. So I think one of the biggest issues we have is not just passing that legislation, but also helping inform people for them to be more conscious consumers of digital content and understand that when they are targeted with certain content, that that is meant to influence them, and starting to take smarter steps in order to protect themselves from that type of influence operation.
David, let me ask you the same thing. Is this a Pandora's box that can't be closed again? You know, on the film, The Great Hack, it's very disturbing to me to see visual images of Black Lives Matter protests and encouraging, you know, almost violent gatherings in that field. Blue Lives Matter designing clash and collision funded by Russian sources, we now know. And it just makes one wonder today, as we look at the toxicity, now I know the U.S. political culture better than others, but the toxicity here, whether we still have this practice underway, and what your views are about somehow getting control of that again.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is the need for these national privacy laws and protection rights to be enforced and put into place. Because in the United States, we don't have the right to ask, for example, a political campaign or its vendors for our data to be able to even know if abusive practices are being used, if people are being marked for targeted for fear-based campaigns or being marked to demobilize them from participation. So I think what the Cambridge Analytica story taught me is that being able to get your basic voter profile seems to be an important aspect of 21st century democracy, to even be able to know if you're the target of abusive practices. And then if you are, what could you do about it? Is there an authority to complain to? Do you have rights in a court to prevent this from happening or to prosecute people for engaging in unlawful practices? We had that ability because of the weirdness that Steve Bannon decided to send U.S. voter data to the U.K. and then weirdly make it part of that country's jurisdiction. If Steve Bannon had kept the Cambridge Analytica data in the United States, I would not have been able to do what I did.
It's so fascinating. Let me just ask you both real quick. Are free and fair elections in the United States, in the UK, really possible now? Brittany?
I believe it's possible, but it's going to take generational change on the education and awareness front for people to understand what happens in election cycles, the types of content they're being shown, the amount of money that is spent on disinformation, both from American political organizations as well as foreign countries that are paying to influence and change who might be elected and who might ascend to certain seats. So that's one thing. Secondly, on the legislation front, we still don't have federal legislation in the United States. There are plenty of countries around the world, especially with supranational legislation in Europe, that are starting to protect people and make these types of political operations that are data-driven a lot more difficult to do. But there's still so much of the world that has a lot to learn and a lot to work on the legislative and regulatory front, where I think the fastest way we're going to see change is by implementing new types of technologies. Interestingly enough, we're going to see over the coming months and years what Elon Musk decides to do with Twitter. One of the biggest issues we've had in elections, something that both Cambridge Analytica use and plenty of organizations around the world use, are fake accounts. So when you create fake accounts on social media, a lot of those are run by bot farms, they're run by AI, and that allows hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands or even millions of messages to be pushed out and shared around the world. And those are not by real people. So Elon has promised two things to the public. One, to get rid of those fake accounts by KYCing everyone on the platform. That is going to make a huge impact on making social media safer. And secondly, to open source the algorithms. One of the things that a lot of legislators and activists like myself have been collaborating on are figuring out how some of these social targeting algorithms actually work, so we can ban certain uses of these algorithms to make social media safer and to make our democracy stronger.
David, what do we need to do to make sure that elections in this country are free and fair?
I would like to see national data protection and data rights legislation be passed in this country so that individual voters can get a handle on how their personal data is being used in the political process, and then mechanisms to redress abuses and to inhibit actors from engaging in abusive practices and creating the kind of transparency that would be necessary. And I think a challenge is that politicians and their campaigns and their super PACs and their donors do not want to be regulated, do not want scrutiny, and they're the ones who make the rules. And so we are in a catch-22 position. We are where we are asking our politicians to allow us some insight and visibility into how they target us for issues and campaigns and campaigning. Right. And it's a tall order, but other countries are doing it, so it's possible.
Yeah, David, from what you've seen from Elon Musk thus far, do you have confidence that he's going to make it a safer, better platform?
Unfortunately, he has motivated a number of people to leave the platform and to seek new places elsewhere on the web in newly emerging decentralized social networks that cannot be purchased and controlled by a billionaire. So it remains to be seen if advertisers will come back to the platform. It remains to be seen if, like, fellow academics like myself feel comfortable and safe there. But it is giving people reason to find alternatives. And I think he should be concerned that he is driving away people, because the power of the platform is the people who are on it.
Brittany, what I found fascinating in your book, and I did read your book, was the journey you went through, but also your experiences with Daniel Ellsberg. And I met Daniel Ellsberg about 30 years ago. We were going into Lawrence Livermore Labs, and there was a big sign above our car that said, "No classified information will be discussed beyond this point." And Daniel Ellsberg said to me, "Let me think of something classified to tell you, Steve." And it was this very electric moment where I felt awkward. I'll never forget it. But it makes me wonder to some degree whether the role you played in Cambridge Analytica as a whistleblower, and other of your colleagues there, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, where we, through them, we learned so much more about essentially the world of official secrecy and about the technical capacity and the digital capacity behind a lot of that intelligence and essentially spying, if you will. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how important that kind of role is. It's not something often discussed. Should we be embracing the Snowdens and the Mannings of the world, or is that, you know, a bridge too far?
I do a lot of work on supporting whistleblowers. I usually have at least one new whistleblower a week reach out to me, and I introduce them to lawyers or the government departments or agencies to which they would need to submit whistleblowing evidence in order to go forward with their complaints. And I believe that we need to strengthen whistleblower law, both in the United States, in Europe, and many other countries around the world that don't yet even have national whistleblowing law. What's so important about what whistleblowers do and are able to provide is original evidence of wrongdoing, whether that be crime, fraud, waste, et cetera. Those are the types of issues that whistleblowers bring up. And that allows not just companies or government organizations to reform, but it allows everyone to be kept safer, both internally and externally to an organization. So when you become a whistleblower, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know who is going to retaliate against you. You don't know if you're going to be blacklisted or ever going to be able to work again. You don't know if you are going to be targeted or if your family will be targeted. It's normally described as a crisis of conscience moment, which means if you decide not to do this, you wouldn't be able to live with yourself. So you do it regardless of the consequences. And for a lot of people, they lose a lot of their rights and have much bigger issues than I did. I was very lucky to be in a position where I was talking about an issue that the entire world started to care about. And so I had many more supporters than detractors. And I've been able to work with legislators and regulators around the world, educators, technologists, in order to help close the gap between technology and ethics. And what was so amazing when I first met Daniel Ellsberg about a month after I became a whistleblower, he sat down with me and he said, "You look very young. How old are you?" I told him I was 30, and he laughed and he said, "I was also 30 when I became a whistleblower. Maybe it's just something about that age." And we had a talk about what it actually meant to make that final decision to go in with your evidence and hope for the best, knowing that it's possible that you have incredibly negative repercussions, but you know you have to do it for the public good.
You know, thank you for that. David, you're active both as an academic, but as an activist, and you write a lot about these issues in the United States. And I imagine in the next Congress that is elected, this is going to become one of the hottest issues. And I'm just interested, as you see the sort of guardrails, and what are the blind spots we're having in this conversation? You know, it occurs to me that I had never heard of Pegasus software, one of the ways in which allegedly the Saudis tracked down my friend Jamal Khashoggi through cell phones and state-based systems that enabled an incredible degree of surveillance. But as you know, I sort of joking and talking about, hey, people's cell phones are spying. Their cars are reporting information on where they drive. We're all part of a data info system, and it just makes me wonder: are we basically hamsters inside a very complex trap now? And how do we get out of it? But I'd just be interested in the guardrails and blind spots that you see in this discussion.
Sure. A big blind spot that attracted me to the scandal initially was the very porous, almost imperceptible boundaries between the election industry and what we refer to as the military-industrial complex, the way that defense contractors and private intelligence companies operate in the same space with the same techniques, the same people, potentially the same data sets. So the way that the parent company of Cambridge Analytica was really started out in defense and then used its techniques for elections and commercial advertising, the failure for us to erect a firewall between intelligence, private intelligence, and then the data ecosystem was one of the key alarming elements. And I'm not sure if we have succeeded at preventing other examples of this dangerous overlap between defense and civilian activity.
Well, listen, we will have to leave it there. Data rights activist Brittany Kaiser, co-founder of Own Your Data. And I have to say, Brittany, great necklace there as you're wearing the Own Your Data jewelry. And David Carroll, associate professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, David.
So what's the bottom line? We all go online and our data's out there. Companies figure us out and they send us ads to satisfy our desires. It sort of starts suggesting a brand of deodorant or a vacation destination. But it winds up recommending who to hate or who to love or who to vote for. Most folks will say, c'est la vie. But it's very much like doping in sports. Once you know the competition is rigged and cheating is rampant, the contest is undermined. That's why democracy seems like it's under threat everywhere. The feeling that everything is being manipulated. Our voices don't matter and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, that's turning people away from hope and change. I don't know if owning your data, like David Carroll and Brittany Kaiser suggest, is a workable solution. But at least being aware of the dangers that exist as we click boxes and give away permissions all day is a good place to start. And that's the bottom line.